most neuroscientists aren't aware of, but I think this is one of the most important discoveries in the last 100 years of neuroscience. It's a collection of studies on an area of the brain called the anterior mid-cingulate cortex. Most people have never heard of this brain area, including many neuroscientists. Talk to a neurosurgeon, they know where it is. You talk to a neuroscientist, unless they teach neuroanatomy, which I happen to, most don't know where it is in the brain. And most didn't know what it did because it hadn't been explored. And then a colleague of mine at Stanford School of Medicine named Joe Parvizi did an incredible study where he was doing neurosurgery and stimulating different brain areas as a means to try and find the location where he needed to do the surgery. And he stumbled upon an area called the anterior mid-cingulate cortex, where if he stimulated with an electrode, people, because they were awake during the neurosurgery, would report feeling as if there was some conflict pressing on them. One even described it as, I feel like I'm driving into a storm, but I feel ready. I can do this. Others reported a different set of words, but the words essentially converged around the same set of subjective experiences, which are, I feel challenged, but I can do it. Mm. This kind of forward center of mass. And then other studies, separate laboratories, discovered that people that take on a new practice that's challenging for them, their anterior mid-cingulate cortex grows in volume. Other people who fail to successfully engage in a regular challenging activity, the anterior mid-cingulate cortex didn't increase in volume in the same way. So very interesting brain structure. And there's, I would say, about a dozen or so really quality studies in humans, a bunch in animal models, but there are a bunch in humans that point to the anterior mid-cingulate cortex as a site in the brain associated with the feeling of tenacity and willpower to push through. It's heavily interconnected with the dopamine reward system, heavily connected, frankly, with a lot of different brain areas. It's a hub for a lot of inputs and outputs. So what do we know about the anterior mid-cingulate cortex? Perhaps most interesting of all is that this is the brain area that seems to preserve its size and even grow in size in what are called superagers. Superagers are people that maintain their cognition later into life. These are people that don't undergo the normal age-related decline in cognition. Separate from Alzheimer's type dementia, you know, everybody as they get older develops less working memory, the ability to keep ideas in mind in the short term. Superagers seem to overcome all that. And they live longer. So you could say, well, this is a case of reverse causality. They live longer, so they have a bigger brain area called the anterior mid-cingulate cortex. We don't really know what the direction of causality is. It could just be correlation. But it all gets ultra interesting when you start to tack together willpower, the taking on of new things, learning things in neuroplasticity and lifespan. And it may be that that quadfecta represents what we think of as the will to live is associated with an intense curiosity and desire to bring in new ideas and modes of thinking. And new ideas and modes of thinking then feed back on our feelings of how we could gain reward, internal reward, of course, dopamine being the universal currency of reward, as a means to move forward. What does this mean? This means that everybody, I believe, can become a better human being by taking on challenges. What is a challenge that can grow the anterior mid-cingulate cortex? Well, unfortunately, it's a challenge that you don't want to engage in. So if you love running, it's not gonna do it. Yeah. If you love resistance training, it's not gonna do it. If you don't want to meditate in the morning and you do 5 minutes or 10 minutes of meditation, then you just enhance the activation of your anterior mid-cingulate cortex. So it's not just about doing hard things, it's about really pushing through resistance. And the reason I bring this up now, as opposed to in a discussion about like how to get more tenacious or have stronger willpower, it will do that. Okay, we know that when the anterior mid-cingulate cortex gets bigger, it translates to a lot of different areas of challenge, not just the area in which you challenged it. The reason is, I believe that this lofty notion of humans evolving to more collective thinking, to embracing new ways to bridge divides that harm human beings at scale or even just locally, is going to emerge only through the willingness to embrace the internal friction that is hearing things and seeing things that we don't like and being able to take a stance of adaptive response, whatever that is. Now, of course, there are things that we hear and see and don't like that activate enough of a sense of injustice in us that's all it does. It just brings us to the point of like wanting to impart justice. But what I'm talking about here are differences in opinion, strongly polarized views that lead to all sorts of things, as we know, good and bad and everything in between. And if people had the capacity to feel that friction and to stay in a mode of some open cognition, I think we would come up with novel solutions. I really think the next iteration of human beings is collective consciousness. Mm. You know, it sounds lofty, sounds woo, but it's basically lots of minds working together, even minds that oppose one another in ideology, as a means to find out novel solutions to hard problems that vex us all, mm. and that in some cases really harm us all. It's a real thing with real possibility, but it's going to require that we all get not necessarily tougher, but that we get more resilient at the level of being able to tolerate internal states mm. that normally would impede adaptive thinking. Always ask me, how cold should the cold plunge be or the cold shower, and how long should I stay in? And it's so variable depending on the person, the time of day. Obviously, only do what's safe, right? So don't go so cold that you can, you know, you can get a cardiovascular effect that's not good. But it's very simple, actually. If you want it to translate into the real world in the best way, you ask yourself right before you get in, on a scale of 1 to 10, how badly do I not want to get in? And I would say that if it's 5 to 10, well, that's a wall. If it's anywhere in the 5, that's one wall you have to get over. So then you get in. And then at some point, there will be the desire to get out. That's the second wall. Maybe it comes within 5 seconds. Maybe it comes within 20 seconds. That's the second wall. So what I would do is count walls. What are the quote unquote walls? The walls are waves of adrenaline being released into your body. And sometimes they are very close together, those waves. And sometimes they're more distantly spaced apart. Now, of course, at some point you go numb and then you don't feel them anymore. We don't suggest that. But if you think to yourself, gosh, today I really don't want to get in, that wall is a really tall wall. Well, just getting in for 15, 20 seconds is going to accomplish something meaningful yes. for this anterior mid cingulate cortex. It's going to accomplish something meaningful for the adrenaline release that you're going to experience. So it's less about the temperature. I mean, obviously the temperature plays a role, than it is your kind of subjective relationship to the whole thing. For instance, if you do cold exposure at night when you're tired, it's a far and away different experience than in the morning after going for a run and you're too warm. So I can't say 45 degrees Fahrenheit for 90 seconds, although if you want to start there, that's fine, provided it's safe for you. But as you watch these walls of adrenaline come at you, as it were, pay attention to what they feel like. That's what you'll recognize outside the ice bath
yeah.
in a hard conversation.
That's what I'm, yeah.
That it's not that you can make yourself so resilient that your adrenaline system doesn't work.
Correct.
It's that you learn to recognize the state of having adrenaline in your system and staying calm. And then I actually had this happen the other day. I was in a really hard, yesterday, a hard conversation, something first thing in the morning. It was like, wait, what? Seriously? Misunderstanding, hard conversation. And I remember, here we are, our voices are going up. We weren't yelling, but like it was a peaceful morning until that moment. And you could kind of feel the energy in the room going up. And I was thinking to myself, okay, how am I? And I thought, oh, this is like a wall in the thing. And I said, because we have this language at home, I said, I feel like there's a wall of adrenaline hitting us. Whether we both kind of started laughing and then we kind of reverted to what we were doing. And then we calmed down. And, you know, we talk about taking breaks, and that's wonderful. It's a wonderful tool that you talked about in your book on relationships. There's so many valuable tools in there, by the way. I just like to thank you for writing that book. So valuable. Everyone should read it. It should be standard curriculum in every school, in every home. I really mean that. Jay doesn't tell me to say this. I really mean this. I really, truly mean it.
You're too kind.
It's entirely appropriate because it's true. But noticing those walls of adrenaline and realizing that when we're in those adrenaline-filled states, our cognition is shifted. We don't have solutions that we had 5 minutes ago. So learning to watch those pass in the cold plunge, in the cold shower, on a hard run or whatever it is, but the cold seems to be the universal stressful stimulus for everybody, is so valuable. More than marking off, you know, 15 minutes or 5 minutes in the cold plunge. Mm. And some days it's 15 seconds, sometimes it's 30. And for somebody learning the cold plunge, it's like, hey, can you just even get near the thing or in it? And I think there's real value. The nervous system loves predictability, even if the predictability is arriving through hard things. So I would say the major theme of the Huberman Lab podcast has been tools, we call them protocols, to anchor one's physiology in some predictable states. I've never actually articulated that, but that's really what it's about. So why get sunlight in your eyes in the morning? Because it wakes you up. I could tell you it increases cortisol in a good way early in the day, that it sets a timer on your melatonin secretion for later at night. It helps you sleep at night. And that's all true, but it creates a sense of predictability. It allows you to know that for the next series of hours, you're going to feel more alert. And at night, you're likely going to be able to fall asleep more easily. Cold plunges, to my mind, people debate whether or not they're valuable for combating inflammation. They are. Whether or not they're valuable for increasing metabolism, probably not to a huge extent. But one thing we know for sure is that they, if done correctly, they're uncomfortable. But after you get out, you have an increase in these three neurochemicals that we call the catecholamines, dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and you feel more energized and slightly blissed out for the next 2 to 4 hours. It's a real effect because those are real chemicals and they've served that role for hundreds of thousands of years in humans, and they will continue to serve that role in humans. So the cold plunge is not so much about pushing yourself as it is figuring out a way that you can overcome a sense of stress and then safely overcome a sense of kind of resistance to getting in the thing, and then safely increase these neurochemicals that then predictably shift your state to be more alert and at the same time relaxed and a little bit blissed out, if we want to call it that. So, you know, we could list off protocol after protocol, right? If you tend to eat meals at a consistent time, plus or minus an hour, doesn't matter if you fast or not, you'll tend to be hungry about 15 minutes or so before those meals. This is a wonderful thing because it increases this predictability. This lends itself to safety and acceptance because it allows you to not have to think about a number of other things. So, you know, I've been criticized, and fairly so, that, gosh, there's so many protocols. How could anyone possibly do all these protocols? And the truth is that many of the protocols are, you know, it's a buffet, and many of them, like how to organize your workspace or when you travel for jet lag, it's individual as to whether or not people want to do them. And of course, they're all optional. You know, this isn't law. So the idea, however, is that through some simple basic behaviors, viewing sunlight, a little bit of a walk after a meal, a little bit of sunlight in the evening, dimming the lights in the evening. You know, these are the basics. Eating at more or less consistent meal times and mostly unprocessed or minimally processed foods for the majority of your food intake, doesn't matter if you're vegan, vegetarian, or otherwise, you're going to feel much, much better. And part of the much, much better is feeling more alert and more vitality during the waking hours and better sleep at night, which just kind of seesaw back and forth into feeling better overall, and thereby free up energy for things like sending the morning text, you know? So I think I'm very glad you brought this up because I think people hear, oh goodness, another thing to do. But if you think about it that way, it's going to be self-limiting. But if you think about it as each one of these things takes a minimum amount of time, and you can do the walk and sunlight thing in the morning combined, and maybe if you miss a day, no big deal, no big deal. These are slow integrative systems. Your system will recover just fine. But done on a consistent basis, you're going to feel much better and you're going to have more energy and you're going to be able to think about what you might want to do in your creative life and then do that. You'll have the time and energy to think about what you might want to do relationship-wise or friendship-wise or building out these aspects of life. So it was never the intention that people do so many things that they don't have time for friendship or kids or relationship, or that their entire family or relationship be centered around these protocols. Rather, they're designed to be weaved into everyday life. And sometimes when people experience pain points, like people are having attentional issues or people are experiencing depression, or they have a particular creative project and they want to tap into like open monitoring meditation, for instance, very different, as you know far better than I, than other forms of meditation, then they can access those specific tools. But I don't want to romanticize ancient times, but there was a lot more predictability in some domains of life in ancient times. Assuming people were living in small villages, there was a lot more predictability, but there was also a lack of predictability. Someone could take off on a hunt or a gather, and if they didn't come back, we might assume they're never coming back. And then 2 nights later, they might come back and say, that was a close call, or they come back with a great yield. We don't know, you know, we don't know what it was like, but you can be sure that the same neural circuits that were responsible for stress and lack of safety and therefore vigilance back then are very much alive in our brains now. So again, the protocols are designed to think about it like putting ingredients in the refrigerator. You don't know what you're going to cook, but you have a lot more available to you as options when you have when you know that all the basic macronutrients are covered, everything's all the bases are covered, and then you can start to think about what you would cook. Whereas if you've ever arrived late in the city, you get to your Airbnb or your hotel, and you see like three or four things and one lousy pan and thing like that. Now you have to get the other kind of creative, where you have to adapt, and we've all done the unhealthy option because that was the only thing, or fasted because that was the healthiest option. So I think what we're getting to here is that the human brain, like all animals need to know where they're going to sleep that night. I mean, a dog goes into a new environment and is like trying to figure out where's its spot. It's all about space. You talk to any expert dog trainer, they'll tell you, you know, it's all about negotiating space. Can they touch you? Can they not touch you? Are they allowed to be near you? Do they have to stay afar? Can they go into every room? You know, you look at small children foraging an environment, however rambunctious or calm, they're trying to figure out like, what am I allowed to do here? What am I not allowed to do here? Sometimes by testing us. As adults, we do the exact same thing. We need to know where we are. We need to orient in space and in time. And then we need to know like what's available to me? Where am I going to stay tonight? Is one of the most fundamental questions that we ask ourselves every single day, except if you know where you're going to stay tonight, you don't ask yourself that, and you have mental real estate to devote to other things. So what we're really talking about here is kind of bookending the extremely basic fundamental drives of the human brain for safety and acceptance. And then at the very other end is these aspirational things that we all seek, right? These notions of connectedness, of purpose, of fulfillment, of peace. Again, I'm borrowing from Martha's beautiful list because I think it's so fundamental and it captures most, if not all, of what we all seek. But I think that, you know, we get very much caught up in the how to reach goal A or B, how to write the book, how to make the money, how to grow a social media account. And we forget that at the core of everything is our relationship to our surroundings, to our inner landscape, and to each other. And it always comes back to safety and acceptance. And where we feel uncomfortable, where we feel like we didn't do things right or others didn't do them right for us or to us, it always boils down to those two things. I'm a big believer in physiology driving mental states. They go the other way too. Emotional states drive physiology. It's bidirectional, of course. One of the reasons why I've been so emphatic about respiration protocols is A, my lab published a clinical trial on this in collaboration with David Spiegel in our Department of Psychiatry, which basically could be summarized the following way. If you emphasize exhales, you tend to calm down, meaning you make them longer, more and intentional. Normally, we inhale actively and we passively exhale. Other species do it the other way around, some other species. If you deliberately emphasize your exhales, the duration, the intensity, or just even control the exhale actively, your heart rate slows. When we emphasize inhales, we don't necessarily have to do hyperventilation or tummo breathing or anything like that. We could, but those forms of breathing tend to bring up our activation state, and they emphasize inhales both by virtue of vigor, duration, or just putting more conscious attention to them. And there's a reason for this. It's called respiratory sinus arrhythmia. It's an actual phenomenon that links the heart and the vagus nerve and our diaphragm and our lungs. It's a beautiful mechanism. When I'm overthinking at night and I want to fall asleep, I start doing long exhale breathing through my mouth. Now, sometimes I'm out. I just fall asleep. I know that because I wake up sometime later, realize it worked again. Other times it doesn't work so well, right? And one of the most common questions I get is how to turn off repetitive thoughts. Mm. Now, there it's a bit of a skill because, you know, frankly, repetitive thoughts oftentimes are serving an adaptive purpose, but we can get stuck on them, right? Or they can get stuck in us. I don't know which one it is. But one of the reasons why I'm such a strong believer in people doing a practice like yoga nidra, mm-hmm. which, you know, and I must say, I know I've upset to some extent some people by coining something very similar, non-sleep deep rest or NSDR, I want to make very clear that I have the utmost respect for yoga nidra as an ancient practice. Neither yoga nidra, of course, nor NSDR were anything I developed. It's just that NSDR, it's a little bit different in that it removes intentions and it tends to involve a little bit less of some of the linking of chakras and things like that that yoga nidra does, with no specific purpose in mind behind designing that way, except to be able to adapt it to the laboratory context. Okay, what do we know about, let's just call it its original name, yoga nidra. The goal is to stay awake, to be conscious while deliberately relaxing the body. That's a very useful practice. Feels similar to meditation in a way. Could be called a meditation, but it has some distinct benefits. First of all, a beautiful study that was done in Denmark at a medical school in Copenhagen showed that people that do a yoga nidra practice get a 60% increase in baseline dopamine levels in the basal ganglia, a brain area that's associated with the preparation for movement and the withholding of movement. So it essentially can be looked at as a practice that changes neurochemicals in the brain that restore mental and physical vigor. That's how I think of yoga nidra. It's sort of like sleep. There are some studies emerging, including some that I'm planning with Dr. Matt Walker at Berkeley, one of the preeminent sleep researchers in the world, that are going to explore whether or not little pockets of the brain are actually sleeping or in rapid eye movement sleep-like states during yoga nidra. If you think about rapid eye movement sleep, just as a very relevant aside, it's a state in which the brain is very active and the body is completely still, much like yoga nidra. Mm. Okay, brain active, body still. Now, what's unique about yoga nidra is that there's this instruction in the nidra, if it's a traditional one, that talks about going from thinking and doing to being and feeling. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's step back as neuroscientists and we say, okay, thinking is a lot about anticipating future. It could be about thinking about the past. It could be thinking about things that are happening now, but it's a very forebrain dependent process. Doing is basal ganglia, action generation, withholding action, and forebrain circuitry as well. You know, I should say prefrontal cortical circuitry as well. Now, being and feeling, now this is starting to sound a little bit like quote unquote softer language, but there's nothing soft about this language, because if we just put a neuroscience lens on it, we say, okay, what is that really about? That's about bringing ourselves from exteroception, monitoring of the external world beyond the confines of our skin, to monitoring of the internal world within the confines of our skin. Mm-hmm. And there's something magical about shifting our perception to interoception from our skin inward, in that it takes us out of thinking. Mm-hmm. Whereas when we're monitoring the external world, for reasons that are sort of logical but a little bit harder to articulate, then it's more about anticipating things, trying to figure out what goes with what's separate from what. The moment we get to the level of our skin and inward, we know what's what and what's separate from what. It's just us inward. It's sort of, there's one thing. Rarely do we think, oh, here's my brain and here's my leg. Now, nidra then steps us through that. And so what it does is it brings all of our cognition into this interoceptive mode, and then boom, we are in this mode of being and feeling. So I don't think of being and feeling as turning off thinking. I think of it as bringing thinking to the level of our sensation of our body. Yoga nidra, I think, is perhaps the most powerful practice for learning how to turn off one's thoughts. And so when one steps back from the research literature and says, okay, what do we know for sure about yoga nidra and NSDR? We know that this can be done for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, or an hour. We know that it can very reliably improve levels of wakefulness, cognition, and vigor post-nidra. We know that it restores dopamine levels to a marked extent in the basal ganglia. We know that the brain goes into little pockets of sleep-like states. This needs to be explored further. And we know that it mimics rapid eye movement sleep. And we know that people who do it find it easier to make themselves fall back asleep should they need to. And they develop much stronger powers of autonomic regulation, their ability to take themselves out of stress if they need to. I mean, if ever there was a powerful practice, yoga nidra is that practice. Mm. And so when I step back from the landscape of practices that can help us turn off thinking or et cetera, this is probably a good time to just, you know, mention that, you know, meditation I view as an exploration of one's own consciousness. I also view it as a perceptual exercise, shifting one's perception to a particular location as opposed to just wherever the mind may take it. Mm-hmm. Put simply, I mean, it's far more profound than that, as you know, and as many know. But meditation has been shown to reduce stress, improve focus, improve memory. I'm thinking mainly of the studies by Wendy Suzuki's lab at NYU. I'm thinking of the studies that were done out of the University of Wisconsin that are talked about in Altered States, which is a wonderful book, and the work that you've talked about in your books. When I think about yoga nidra, non-sleep deep rest, it's really about restoring mental and physical vigor and getting better at regulating one's own autonomic internal kind of hinge, going back and forth between sympathetic and parasympathetic, that, you know, kind of fight or flight and rest and digest, alert and calm, learning how to adjust that in a conscious way. And then when I think of practices like breath work, well, it depends on the breath work. And then we can simplify it by saying when inhales are more vigorous and made longer deliberately than exhales, heart rate goes up, alertness goes up. When exhales are made longer and more vigorous and done deliberately, well, then heart rate tends to go down and we tend to shift more towards a state of calm. And then, of course, there's hypnosis. And hypnosis to me is self-hypnosis, which is a clinical tool that David Spiegel and others around the world, but mainly David Spiegel and his father, popularized within the formal field of psychiatry. And hypnosis is a combination of alertness and calm that we know lends itself to neuroplasticity. What is hypnosis really for? It's not meditation, it's not to calm down, it's to solve a specific problem, to quit smoking, to learn how to regulate pain, to any number of different things that hypnosis has been shown in peer-reviewed studies to do. So when I step back, I say, okay, meditation, non-sleep deep rest, aka yoga nidra, or I should say yoga nidra, aka non-sleep deep rest, breath work and hypnosis. Well, now we have a kit of tools that are available to us to kind of adjust our internal state. And any one of those could be used to turn off thinking. But the most powerful one, in my opinion, and by way of experience and sort of how I'm viewing the research literature, I'm sure there are others out there that would disagree with me, and that's fine, is yoga nidra. If ever there was a practice that I wish every human being on the planet would do besides go out and view morning sunlight, it would be yoga nidra. Mm-hmm. And of course, this has been available for thousands of years. And unfortunately, it has not gotten the traction worldwide that I think it deserves. And especially at this time in human history, when the world seems so tense with friction of all sorts of kinds, but also internal friction for people, I think it's just, it's something that I really, really want to shine a light on. Mm-hmm. as a tremendously beneficial tool.
Yeah.
For turning off thoughts.
Yeah.
When it's necessary, and for accessing, you know, some people call these atypical states, but most people go from sleep to waking and sleep to waking without really an exploration of what those different states are like. Question was about so-called ultradian rhythms. For those of you that are not familiar with ultradian rhythms are any rhythms that are shorter than 24 hours. And typically when people ask about or talk about ultradian rhythms, they are referring to 90-minute rhythms. I've talked about these on the podcast before. And Jackson's question was, how do you use ultradian rhythms in your daily work? There's more to the question, but first off, I do use ultradian rhythms. That is, I leverage the fact that these do exist in all of us as a way to engage in focused bouts of mental work once or twice or sometimes three times per day. However, I use them in a way that's grounded in the research on ultradian rhythms for learning and memory in a way that might not be obvious just from their name, that they are 90-minute rhythms. So I'll get into the details of how to use ultradian rhythms to best capture neuroplasticity, that is, the brain's ability to change in response to experience, and in a way that should allow you to get one or two or maybe even three focused bouts of learning per day, which can greatly accelerate learning of cognitive material, languages, mathematics, history for sake of school or work, or maybe just a hobby or a personal interest of some sort, and for skill learning in the physical domain as well. Jackson then went on to ask, you've mentioned before that you try to include at least one 90-minute focus block per day as part of your work and overall mission. And indeed, that is true. I try to get at least one of these focused ultradian rhythm blocks per day. That is a period of about 90 minutes where I'm focused on learning something or doing something that's cognitively hard, although typically I aim for two of these sessions per day. He then goes on to ask, what is the maximum number of blocks you can perform sustainably? The answer to that is probably four. And I say probably because some people have schedules, lifestyles in which four 90-minute blocks of focused learning is possible per day, but that's highly unusual. For most people, it's going to be one or two, maybe three. Four, I would place in the really extraordinary end of things. Maybe if you're cramming for exams or you've managed to go on a writing retreat or a learning retreat of some sort where you can devote essentially all of your non-sleeping, non-eating time to learning. But most people simply can't organize their life that way. So the short answer is, for me, it's one or two per day is the target, and three would be the maximum. He then went on to ask, do you take vacations or extended breaks from these alternating rhythm sessions? And the short answer is no. Typically, I try and do this every day, and yes, even on the weekends. But on the weekend, the alternating rhythm focused learning bout might just be reading a book for about 90 minutes or so, which might not be as cognitively difficult as it is for other sorts of work that I perform during the week. I occasionally miss a day entirely for whatever reason, travel, obligations related to family, etc. But in general, I try and do this every day. I do think that the circuits for focus are, I guess the non-biological way to put it would be kept warm, but essentially that accessing the circuits for focus is made easier by accessing them regularly. And that's because the circuits for focus are indeed themselves amenable to neuroplasticity. In other words, the more you force yourself to focus, the easier focusing gets. Okay, so as I mentioned before, ultradian rhythms are these 90-minute cycles that we go through from the time that we are born until the time we die. Indeed, even during sleep, we are experiencing and more or less governed by these ultradian rhythms. This question and this answer is not so much about sleep, but just know that when you go to sleep at night until you wake up in the morning, every 90 minutes or so, your patterns of sleep, that is the percentage or ratio rather of slow wave sleep to light sleep to rapid eye movement sleep, changes in a way such that each 90-minute cycle gates the next cycle. It sort of flips the on switch for the next 90-minute cycle, then that 90-minute cycle ends, flips the on switch for the next one, and so on and so forth. I mention all that because during the daytime, the same thing is true, but most people don't know when the 90-minute ultradian cycles begin. Because if you think about it, you could wake up on the basis of an alarm clock or noise in the room, or simply because you naturally wake up in the middle of an ultradian 90-minute cycle. So does that mean, for instance, that if you wake up 60 minutes into an ultradian cycle, that the next 30 minutes of your waking, right, because that 60 minutes needs to continue to 90 to complete an ultradian cycle, that the next 30 minutes after waking are related to the ultradian cycle that you were still in during sleep? Or does it start a new ultradian cycle? And the answer is the former. That ultradian cycle continues even if you wake up in the middle of it. And so a lot of people who want to leverage ultradian cycles for learning will say, well, how do I know when to start one? Does it start when I hit my stopwatch? Can I just set a clock and work for 90 minutes? And the short answer is no. And that might seem unfortunate, but the good news is that you can figure out when your first proper ultradian cycle of the day begins simply by asking yourself, when are you most alert after waking? That is, if you were, say, to wake up at 7 a.m., and let's say that's the end of an ultradian cycle, or perhaps you're in the middle of an ultradian cycle, doesn't matter. What you need to watch for or pay attention to for a day or so is when you start to experience your greatest state of mental alertness in the morning. And here we can discard with all the issues and variables around caffeine or no caffeine, hydrating or no hydrating. Exercise is one variable that we'll consider in a moment, but here's the deal. These ultradian cycles are actually triggered by fluctuations in the so-called glucocorticoid system, the system that regulates cortisol release. And as some of you have probably heard me say before, cortisol, even though it's often discussed as a terrible thing, it's, you know, chronic stress, cortisol, etc. Cortisol is essential for health. And every day we get a rise in cortisol in the morning that is associated with enhanced immune function, enhanced alertness, enhanced ability to focus, so on and so forth. In fact, the protocol that I'm always beating the drum about, that people should get sunlight in their eyes as close to waking as possible, that actually enhances or increases the peak level of cortisol that's experienced early in the day. And that sets in motion a number of these ultradian cycles. So for instance, if you wake up at 7 a.m. and you find that for the first hour after waking, you tend to be a little bit groggy, or you happen to be groggy on a given day, but then you notice that your attention and alertness starts to peak somewhere around 9:30 a.m. or 10 a.m., you can be pretty sure that that first ultradian cycle for learning is going to be optimal to start at about 9:30 or 10 a.m. How can I say about if it's indeed a 90-minute cycle? Well, this is really where the underlying neurobiology and these ultradian cycles converge to give you a specific protocol. The changes in cortisol that occur throughout the day involve, yes, a big peak early in the day if you're getting your sunlight and caffeine and maybe even some exercise early in the day. But typically that peak comes early, and then across the day, the baseline jitters a little bit. It comes down, but it bounces around a little bit. It's not a flat line if we were to measure your glucocorticoid levels. Each one of those little bumps corresponds to a shift in these ultradian cycles. So if you find that you are most alert at 9:30 or starting to become alert at 9:30, and then typically you have a peak of focus and concentration around 10 a.m., that is really valuable to know, because the way that the molecules that control neuroplasticity, that is the changes in neurons and other cell types in the brain that allow your nervous system to learn and literally for new connections to form between neurons, which is basically the basis of learning, those fluctuate according to these ultradian cycles. What does this mean? This means if your peak in alertness and focus and energy, could even be experienced as physical energy, occurs at about 9:30 a.m., I would start your first ultradian cycle for learning somewhere around there. Certainly 9:30 a.m. would be ideal, but 10 a.m. would be fine as well. And then you have about 1 hour to get the maximum amount of learning in, even within that ultradian cycle. This is where there's a lot of confusion out there. People think, oh, ultradian cycles are 90 minutes. Therefore, we should be in our peak level of focus throughout that 90 minutes. In reality, most people take about 10 or 15 minutes to break into a really deep trench of focus. And then periodically throughout the next hour, they'll pop out of that focus and have to deliberately refocus. This is why, if possible, you want to turn off Wi-Fi connections and put your phone in the other room or turn it off. If you do need your phone or Wi-Fi, just be aware of how distracting those things can be to getting into a deep trench of focus. But the point is this, these 90-minute cycles occur periodically throughout the day, but there is going to be one period early in the day, and here I'm referring to this period as starting at about 9:30 or 10 a.m., and then likely another one in the mid to late afternoon that are going to be ideal for focused learning. And that focused learning bout should ideally have you set your clock, a stopwatch or something, to measure 90 minutes, but do assume that there's going to be some jitter at the front end where you're not going to be able to focus as deeply as you would like. Then you'll get about an hour of deep focus, and then you really start to transition out of these ultradian cycles. How do you know when the afternoon ultradian cycle occurs? Well, just as in the morning, it occurs because there's a brief but significant increase in the glucocorticoid system in the mid to late afternoon. I wish I could tell you it's going to be 2 p.m. or it's going to be, it's going to be 3 p.m. That's really going to depend on the individual, when you ingest caffeine, some of the other demands of your day. But you can learn to recognize when these two periods for optimized learning will occur. And here are the key principles. Watch for a day or two, meaning pay attention to when you have your peak levels of physical and mental energy in the morning, that is between waking and noon. And then again, between noon and about 6 or 7 p.m., although I'm sure that there are some late-shifted folks that will experience their peak in focus somewhere around 6 or 7 p.m., especially if they're waking up around 10 or 11 a.m., as I know some people out there are. Once you know where those peaks in focus occur on your schedule, set a stopwatch for one ultradian cycle in the early part of the day. In this example, I was saying 9:30, but if you can't hop on it until 10, that's fine. Set it for 90 minutes. Consider that block wholly, meaning rule out all other distractions, but assume that within that 90-minute block, you are only going to be able to focus intensely for about 1 hour. And just know that the molecules that control neuroplasticity, and these things have names, and yes, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, is sort of the most famous of those, but there are others as well. In fact, the very receptors that control synaptic strength, the connections between neurons, some of the neurotransmitters and neuromodulators involved in synaptic plasticity, they undergo regulation by these ultradian changes in glucocorticoid. And then try and capture a second ultradian learning block in the afternoon. Again, just knowing that the first 10 or 15 minutes, consider it mental warm-up, and then you get about an hour, it's not exactly 60 minutes, but about an hour to maximize learning. So if you're trying to learn something, really capture it during that phase as well. Now, is there a third opportunity or a fourth opportunity? This relates to Jackson's question directly. And the short answer is not really. You know, unless you're somebody who requires very little sleep, within the 12 or 16 hours that one tends to be awake during the day, or 18 hours that one tends to be awake, there are really only two of these major peaks in the glucocorticoid system that trigger the onset of these circadian cycles. Again, there's sort of a ramping up and a ramping down of glucocorticoids throughout the day. But the real key here is to learn when you tend to be most focused based on your regular sleep-wake cycle, caffeine intake, exercise, etc. And again, that's going to vary from person to person. And you really only have two opportunities or two ultradian cycles to capture in order to get the maximum focus challenging work done, aka learning. So for somebody that wants to learn an immense amount of material, or who has the opportunity to capture another ultradian cycle, the other time where that tends to occur is also early day. So some people, by waking up early and using stimulants like caffeine and hydration or some brief high intensity exercise, can trigger that cortisol pulse to shift a little bit earlier so that they can capture a morning work block that occurs somewhere, let's say, between 6 and 7:30 a.m. So let's think about our typical person, at least in my example, that's waking up around 7 a.m. And then I said, has their first ultradian work cycle really flip on because that bump in cortisol around 9:30 or 10 a.m. If that person were, say, to set their alarm clock for 5:30 a.m., then get up, get some artificial light if the sun isn't out, you know, turn on brighter artificial lights, or if the sun happens to be up that time of year, get some sunlight in your eyes. But irrespective of sunlight, were to get a little bit of brief high-intensity exercise, maybe 10 or 15 minutes of skipping rope or even just jumping jacks, or go out for a brief jog, what happens then is the cortisol pulse starts to shift earlier. And so the next day and the following day and so on and so forth, provided they're still doing that exercise first thing and ideally getting some light in their eyes as well, well, then they have an opportunity to capture an increase in cortisol that is now shifted from about 7 a.m. to about 8:30 a.m. So they can capture an hour of work there. And then they will also still be within that rising phase of cortisol in the 9:30 to 10 a.m. block that lasts until about, you know, 11:30 or so. They might have lunch. Perhaps after lunch, they do a non-sleep deep rest. Maybe they don't. Maybe you're a napper. Maybe you're not. Doesn't really matter. And then in the afternoon, and I would suspect it would now be in the earlier afternoon, sometime around 2 or 2:30 would be typical. Although again, that exact time will vary person to person. Then they would want to schedule another 90-minute work block. So that's how you can capture three. Now you can start to see also why capturing four ultradian work blocks would be exceedingly rare. It's just not typical that people are awake for that much of the day. You have to sleep at some point. Should mention that if you're going to force yourself to wake up earlier on a consistent basis, you probably should be trying to get to sleep a little bit earlier as well, because it's not just the quality but the duration of quality sleep that really matters for learning. And I should also remind everybody that the actual rewiring of neurons does not occur during any focused work block. It actually occurs during deep sleep the following night and the following night, and during non-sleep deep rest. This is why non-sleep deep rest can accelerate learning, because it's in states of rest that the actual connections between neurons strengthen or weaken, or new neurons are added in a way that allows for what we call learning. Okay, so one or two ultradian work blocks per day is typical. Three would be really exceptional, and four would be extraordinary. Look for them, meaning look to see when you are feeling most focused and alert, typically in the period before waking and noon, and typically in the period between noon and bedtime, given your standard intake of caffeine and exercise and other life events. Please Also remember that even though it's an ultradian 90-minute work block, the neuroplasticity is going to be best triggered within a 60-minute portion of that. And there's no way to know exactly when that 60 minutes begins and ends until you actually begin the work block. So this is really designed to be empirical. You need to actually go do this. What you'll notice again is that it's hard to focus at first, then you'll drop into a state of focus. You may get distracted. That's perfectly normal. You refocus, get back into triggering learning. That's really what you're doing. You're triggering learning, and then there'll be some taper, and then you'll be out of the ultradian work block. Now, it's also key to understand that myself and other people should not expect that they're only working during these 90-minute work blocks. It's just that a lot of the sorts of demands of our day, including, you know, cooking and shopping for groceries and email and text messaging and social media, a lot of those things don't require intense focus of the sort that I believe Jackson is asking about maximizing and that I'm referring to when I talk about these ultradian work blocks. And then as a final point, I've been talking about these ultradian work blocks and focus, et cetera, in a context that brings to mind ideas about cognitive work. So learning a language, learning math, writing or creating, doing something related to music, et cetera. But these 90-minute ultradian work blocks also directly relate to physical skill learning as well and to physical exercise as well. So if you are somebody who's really interested in improving your fitness and your fitness requires a lot of focused attention, so for instance, when I go out for a long run on Sundays, which is part of my fitness routine, I'm deliberately not thinking about much. I'm just trying to cruise along. I might focus a little bit on my pace and stride, maybe an audiobook I'm listening to or a podcast, but typically I'm just kind of cruising along. It's low cognitive demand work. These ultradian work blocks can really be maximized for pure cognitive work, so kind of book type work, et cetera, music, et cetera, or they can also be leveraged toward skill learning. So if you're trying to learn how to dance or how to perform a particular athletic move, or you're trying to get better at some skill that requires a lot of focus and alignment of muscular movement and cognitive demands, et cetera, well, then these are also going to be ideal for triggering neuroplasticity to get better in the motor skill-based domain, as it's called. Greatest sense of safety seems to arrive from not trying to control everything. Mm-hmm. It's counterintuitive, right? You know, we think, okay, well, how do you get safety? Well, you have to get rid of vigilance. How do you get rid of vigilance? Well, you decide what you do and don't have to pay attention to. And at some point, if one decides, I can't control all of this, you have one of two options. Either that means you're just waiting for that wave to come demolish you, wave of whatever, or you trust, like you trust in something to make everything okay, mm-hmm. even if that wave comes, you know. And I've talked before on podcasts, I believe in God, I do, you know, and of course I believe in everyone's right to believe or not believe what they believe in. I think that the notion of giving up trying to control everything and giving over control to more universal forces or a universal force, whatever one's mode of thinking happens to be, I believe they're entitled to, is probably the most peace-inducing step I've ever taken. And I thought it would be, you know, matched with a little sneaking, you know, voice in the back. Yeah, but it's not. And I don't know how that works at the level of neuroscience. I know there are neuroscientists who are trying to explore this. And as the data evolve, I'll certainly pay attention to it, not with the intention of trying to undermine any kind of larger sense of anything, but just out of interest.
For sure. Right?
I'd love to see it. It's far too interesting. There's actually a woman at Stanford. I haven't yet to talk to her. We should both talk to her. She said, I forget her name at the moment because I just learned about her work in the Department of Anthropology, who has spent her entire career studying people's inner voices, people who hear voices, people who hear the voices of others. And sure, this sometimes goes into the domain of people who have auditory hallucinations and so forth, but also just these different scripts that people have in their mind that include their own voices and other voices, voices we've internalized from childhood. This resonates with me a lot because when I was a kid, after my parents would put me to sleep, I used to arrange dialogues between people I had heard that day, and I could hear their voices in very clear ways in my head. And I would remember things they said, and I could create these dialogues. And so I've also always had a very strong audiographic memory. It's not as if everything I hear I remember verbatim. That actually would be a super skill. It would have saved me in a lot of arguments. but in all seriousness, I think what you describe about essentially a letting go or a giving over of the need for that control that we all experience, the desire for control, is really where the solution lies, I think. I know this because many people have said it, and it's very hard to do, but that once one does it once, you can do it again.
Yeah.
And it's a practice.
It's a practice.
It's not you write it down and it's done. It's a practice. And, I also am thinking about the kind of counterintuitive nature of the fact that, we're talking at once about letting go and not trying to control everything, but also pushing oneself to be more resilient and tenacious and things of that sort. And so I feel like all of life is like that. All of life is about, yes, you need to take care of your physiology. You need to get your sleep at night, but it's also okay to get a bad night's sleep every once in a while. It's okay to not do every protocol. In fact, it's encouraged to not do every protocol. The expectation on us is not perfection, right? It's I think, being able to toggle between these different states.